Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
I'm Blake Howard. This is the last 12 minutes of the Mohicans. A Michael Mann film-inspired podcast tackling everything about the 1992 film, The Last of the Mohicans, through a very specific lens. Its finale. And oh boy, is it an all-timer of a finale. Soaring score from Randy Edelman and Trevor Jones's adaptation of The Gale. Unbelievable performances by Daniel Day-Lewis, Madeline Stowe, Russell Means, Eric Schwieg, Jodie May, Steve Waddington. Lensed so stunningly and staggeringly by the legendary Dante Spinotti. And directed by Michael Mann. We have a war party of cinema's sharpest minds along for the ride, all culminating with the mountainous director himself, Mr. Mann. Welcome to the show.
This is not my guest's first rodeo talking about Michael Mann to me on a podcast. He is an Edgar Award-winning author. He is currently in the writer's room of Dune, The Sisterhood, which is freaking amazing. And he devastates me every time when I read his Twitter bio because he talks about his doomed LA Confidential pilot, which I absolutely love and adore. He's one of my favorite people, Jordan Harper. Welcome to this, the last 12 minutes of the Mohicans.
So glad to be back with you as always. Now, I do not have any Natty Bumpo action figures. And let's just start, if I may, before you get going. I just want to know, does anybody call him Natty Bumpo in the film Last of the Mohicans?
No, they don't.
No.
Not a single because Natty Bumpo.
It's a stupid name.
It is a really dumb name. It's really dumb. It's Nathaniel Poe. Apparently meant to be a Edgar Allan Poe homage. I think I'm right at saying
nope,
that. Like,
No, I'm not saying you're wrong factually. I'm just saying it's not.
No. Okay, good. That's good. That's good.
Have you, in your course of recording this or just in your research, have you talked about the Mark Twain review of this book?
No, I briefly touched on it with Walter Chaw, but I would love if you could bring it up in more detail because, yes, James Fenimore Cooper, if you talk about literary criticism, the kind of worst human living or dead to criticize your work written down would be one of the greatest writers almost ever, Mark Twain, who eviscerated James Fenimore Cooper's novel and said it broke like all of the rules of narrative fiction. But if you could please sort of elaborate on that, that would be just wonderful.
Yeah, well, it is one of the most vicious takedowns that you will ever read in any format. And, you know, whenever there's like a universally derided movie nowadays, every movie critic just gets overjoyed to get to kind of throw their little punches out and stomp the guy who's down. But like, I don't think James Fenimore Cooper was well regarded when Twain did this. And he wrote, I don't have it in front of me. If I had to guess, it is 5,000 words minimum.
Yes.
And he starts with the rules of fiction. He goes through the fact, and you do see this in the movie, the fact that Natty Bumppo's diction twists from the amazingly poetic to the absolutely down home with sort of no sense that can be seen. At one point, he literally takes an action scene and deconstructs it and kind of holds it up to the light and says, this literally makes no physical sense. And it is just, if you haven't read it, it's up there with like Hunter S. Thompson's obituary for Richard Nixon as like a thing that must be read. And it's just like an old school diss track. And it's really, it was my first exposure to Last of the Mohicans. I had a book of like a omnibus of American comedy when I was a kid. And it had like all sorts of crap and funny things in it. But that was like one of the centerpieces. And I don't know, when did this movie come out? It was 92?
This is 92, yeah, the Michael Mann version, yeah. 92.
So, yeah, I definitely read this. So I had that in my head when I saw this movie. And obviously, I have not read the book, Last of the Mohicans. The movie is apparently a huge improvement on the book.
Yeah, significant. Absolutely significant on the book, by all accounts. That's kind of universally now understood. But I'm going to, the actual piece, just for folks, I've been Googling while Jordan and I've been talking, it's called Fenimore Cooper's Literary Offenses by Mark Twain. And he goes, this is just one of the best quotes. Cooper's art has some defects. In one place in Deerslayer and the restricted space of 2/3 of a page, Cooper has scored 114 offences against the literary art out of a possible 115. It breaks the record. There are 19 rules governing literary art that are made of romantic fiction. Some say 22. In Deerslayer, Cooper violated 18 of them. These 18 require, and he literally itemizes every rule that he completely breaks. It's wonderful. It's a really wonderful read.
Well, and to your point of like, you know, you can always use the defense of, well, come on, what's a critic know? Or isn't that just like a critic to diss? And it's like, he wrote Huck Finn. He's one of the greatest living, or not living, right? He's one of the great, great American writers for sure.
Yeah. I think when you're being schooled, like that would almost be like a filmmaker getting a review by Martin Scorsese. Like, yeah. Whatever Martin Scorsese says, you really kind of have to cop it on the chin. Like, if he hates it, it's like, yep.
Shit, I made a shitty movie. That sucks.
Yeah. It could be universally praised. And Scorsese's like, that movie sucked. It'd be like, right, back to the drawing board, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's true. But that's obviously taking the Mohicans wide. And you're here to talk about the last 12 minutes, is it?
Yes, it is.
I think I said this when you first said this. I have probably seen Last of the Mohicans, the entire film, I don't know, 10 times.
Yes.
You know, some kind of, and I have seen the last 12 minutes of Last of the Mohicans probably 50 times.
Yes.
I own it on iTunes. I just scroll ahead. I will, oh, what am I doing? Nothing. Okay, let's watch the last 12 minutes of Last of the Mohicans. It's really perfect filmmaking.
Isn't it just and this is what I want to backtrack with you, Jordan, is like to orchestrate that kind of perfectly executed cinematic ending where all the emotions are conveyed, very little is said, everything is then being distilled in huge cinematic images, in scale, in speed, in movement. Once you've loved this movie and you've kind of like churned through it as many times as you and I have, like watched it over and over again, that final 12 minutes, you don't like, there's a shorthand that you have as a relationship with it. It's like, you feel all the things you felt in the preceding stuff. And you just get to this ending and you go, I could watch this just on a loop. And in fact, as part of this project, on a couple of days in a row, I was watching it on a loop, to get myself familiar with it. But I could not agree with you more. Every single part of its convergence to this moment is just like, oh, sublime. Chef's kiss.
You know, the scene that precedes it is interesting and very well made, in that, you know, there's the amazing sequence of like the triple translation that is going on. Yeah. There's all the wheeling and dealing. There's the elder I'm sorry, I don't know anybody's names except for Magua.
I think they call him Sashim, which is, I believe, Sashim. I think it's Sashim, but I think that's a title. It's like a chief. Sashim is what they call the Huron chief, I guess, what you call the chieftain.
And you know what's interesting about it is, like, the deal they cook up is sort of nonsensical. It's just like, well, we're going to kill this person, but no, we'll kill you. Oh wait, no, we're going to kill him. But I think the thing that I really want to talk about is that, much like many modern Marvel films, they have to make Magua do a couple of nasty things in this film, because at the core of this movie, Magua is correct.
100%. A t-shirt that is coming out of this show is Magua was right.
he's very similar to, you've seen the new Planet of the Apes movies?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. The villain of the second movie, which I think is the best of the three.
Yeah, Koba. Koba
was right. I think
Koba was
I might have deleted it by now, but if you search my Twitter, I think you can find tweets of me saying Koba was right. And they're very Magua-esque in that essentially these are arguments against colonialism.
Yes.
In both cases, and arguments against the fact that white people just get to eat everything in the fucking world. And the only way they can make those people the bad guys is to have them commit a few extraneous murders.
Yes.
But like Magua, really his only crime, because he's totally correct to kill Madeline Stowe's father.
Yes.
That guy's a dick. he put Magua's family under the knife. And so you can kind of argue in a revenge sense, is it really fair to go eye for an eye and wipe out this guy's family? I would say, sure, why not?
Some of our vengeful heroes. Let's just talk about like one of the biggest revenge franchises going around right now, John Wick. John Wick's taken an eye for an eye for an eye for an eye for an eye over three movies, right? So like Magua just killing the guy who killed his family and then killing his family. A bit dark, but taking his life, I totally agree. It's taking a much more elemental and sort of communal view of like, if I don't care that you're a colonial superpower, I don't care you're a general, I don't care if you do it under this banner of war, you killed my family, I can kill you.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, obviously Daniel Day-Lewis is fantastic. Wes Studi is as good as he is in this movie, if not better.
On repeat watches, I'm closer to saying that he's the best thing in this movie. Because when they go toe to toe in this wonderful triple translation outlaying of tribal judgment to try and appease people's different motivations on different scales, the Sashim's trying to do some really, it's actually very sophisticated attempts at diplomacy based on the circumstances of like everyone just wants blood. Like he knows he's in this sense, his tribe wants blood. He knows that Magua most certainly wants blood. And he's also trying to appease these other tribal people because he knows that in some senses they're his partners. But in that moment, especially because there's a couple of things that happen. And this is like where you see that later on, Daniel Day-Lewis is the best actor of his generation from like There Will Be Blood. Is there's a moment where like Magua is so good that he's cursing out a Huron chief in French, which I think is more insulting. He's cursing him out in French. And then he's standing toe-to-toe with Daniel Day-Lewis, and Daniel Day-Lewis just feels like he's being dwarfed. In fact, in that moment, the two people that saw out of the trio that are in front of us are really Steve Waddington as Duncan Hayward, who's doing this incredible triple translation and negotiation, and Magua, because they're and Daniel Day-Lewis is raw and big and melodramatic, and that's what he needs to be as a character. He's the great American hero, but it's the sophistication of those two other guys in those moments, I think, that like intentionally kind of dwarf him, because the whole movie's been his really until now in this movie.
Yeah. And so from that perspective, when you really get into it, the ending, if we move like from that scene and the idea that Magua is right, the last 12 minutes of this film are incredibly depressing.
Very.
Because nobody wins anything.
Nope.
But obviously, you know, like everybody's going to bring up the score. One of the all-time great scores. Mm-hmm. The location work, please ask man about scouting that cliff. How do you
North Carolina. Found Thomas Cole, literal Thomas Cole paintings in the North Carolina mountains. And Chris Tapley, the wonderful Chris Tapley, was on this show. He's had friends and stuff in school in his local hometown in North Carolina that actually worked on set during this time, you know, digging out the forts and helping with costumes and whatnot. Like, it was a huge production. But yeah, to find this wilderness that's just seems like it's boundless, right? Feels like an ocean. Like, in those sweeping landscape shots. Like, and this is the old days where, and for folks who haven't heard the final episode of One Heat Minute, one of my personal highlights in that was when he talked about, you know, shooting Last of the Mohicans, they had to alter flight paths so that there wouldn't be contrails in the air over the North Carolinian mountains when they were shooting on certain days. And Mann himself even said, like, now I wouldn't care. I wouldn't get any of the traffic to move. I'd just spend $1,000 and just get it fixed in post-production. So it was a nice little insight onto the practicality of, but at the time, to make that authenticity, it's like, no, we're literally negotiating with flight paths for this, you know, this state's airports. It's like, don't fly over here for the next few days because we need to shoot these shots in the movie.
That's incredible. And, you know, it really, it's one of the only, and I'm sure you'll have examples, there are not many great action films I can think of that take place during the guns can shoot one bullet era.
No, it's hard. It's really hard.
Well, I'll just say, you know, and I would love to, somebody must have written about this extensively. There are no great Revolutionary War films that I'm aware of.
No.
The American Revolution is nobody likes it. And my main argument, I have this argument a lot about all sorts of different kinds of TV shows. You essentially cannot make a really good period piece about a place nobody wants to be. Like, and nobody wants to dress like the Madeleine Stowe's dad in this movie, you know, with like the dumb powdered wig, the George Washington look. Do you know how uncomfortable those guys had to have been?
And I love how Duncan lives that, right? Duncan's this prim, proper, you know, thoughtful, you know, very trim. And then later on, he's got that wild, like Waddington's wild, long red hair. He's like, he's, you know, he's, it's all being, all this cordiality is being stripped away, clawed off of his body. Like, get this fucking powdered wig off, man. Get it out of here.
Well, and it's much like, you know, there are some Civil War movies, but that's just because we're weird about that.
Yes.
But like that whole era, you never want to watch a movie set in New York in that era, other than the gangs in New York, but that's kind of an exception, and even that movie's not great. But the entire like late 18th century, or 1800s, I mean, late 19th century, is such a shitty time for humanity, and there's no romance to it. Obviously, this is pre that, I know, but I'm just saying, like, you can do the Old West, you can do Daniel Day-Lewis running through the forest and shooting deer, but the actual, like, white people's story of that time is very unromantic in a very basic way.
Yes, definitely. And I think it's also deeply fascinating. I think this is what this movie gets right that so many others that they don't know how, or they don't seem to have an approach to it, is that Mann is really unabashed about going, this is a rich nation of Native American peoples that is being essentially smashed into oblivion by two huge international colonial superpowers who are just like treading over their land, and they're just trying to maintain their way. And we only skirt in this movie at the Albanys and things like that into the British getting their foothold more so than the French in the landscape in the country. And obviously the French divvy up and take Canada and becomes a, you know, a French colonial space for the longest time. And then similarly, the England pre-Revolutionary War is, you know, the Americas. And so I think it's like, this for me is like the perfect morsel of that movie, because it doesn't diminish any of the complexity of what the political and landscape is. But then because it's so laser focused on like what starts as three, then is essentially six characters. And then all the way to the end, it's just another three characters again. Like, they're just in amongst this war. And I love that style of storytelling, because like that feels like almost Gone with the Wind esque or Good, the Bad and the Ugly. Like, hey, how three, you know, people with their own motivations are navigating around actual wars. But they don't give a shit about the war. The war is just the background, like, because their purposes are around the war. Like, the war's going to happen because there's bigger shit happening in the world, but they're focused on what their pursuits are. And so I think that that's what's... I genuinely think it's a fascinating time. I think some TV shows are trying it. They just don't... I don't know if they've got the scale yet or the complexity yet or the approach yet, but I think there's a lot to be learned in structurally going... No, we need to make sure we are as rigorous and as authentic with what the landscape is, and then we can tell micro stories that help you channel some of the complexity through these simpler sort of archetypal characters.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that movies are the correct place to tell stories of this scope. You know, you're not my therapist, so I won't charge you for this, but I'll tell you that as somebody who's worked in television for a decade, I had this really alarming realization about myself this week, which is that I really believe that film is the far superior storytelling method to television, because it has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
And very, very, very few TV shows do. The ones that do are spectacular, but there's always going to be soft spots. There's always going to be bad episodes. There are movies with no bad scenes.
Yep.
I think
I know one of them. I spoke about it for 2 years.
Yes, exactly. There's no television show that exists past a season or two with no bad episodes.
Correct.
But sometimes
TV shows have to come back around to another season. Like, you look at something like The Wire, one of the most ambitious television shows of all time. You get it and you go, all right, here's season one, essentially perfect. Season two, very aspirational in terms of the landscape, but people would say that's a softer season. Season three is starting to come back, and then you get to season four, and it's like, oh, that's perfect again. Like, you know, even in arguably...
But then it goes to five, and it's bad
again. And then five isn't great, but it's like, at the same time, when The Wash, it's like, you know, to Alan Sepinwall and Matt Zolozaitis' great book, like, they did a book called TV, The Book. That's why they rated something like Deadwood, which is a much shorter show in all until the conclusion movie, so highly because it didn't have a lot of time to stick around and lag. It was so potent and so sharp and short that it's like the level is so high. You know, I say that for True Detective season one, and I love that anthology style. Like, True Detective season one is perfect. Forget the rest of the series, it has its issues, please, but season one is as high a watermark as television gets in my mind.
That's interesting. I feel like Deadwood, actually, I think the third season did, you could see it starting to fall apart. But I think for me, season two of Deadwood is as good as television has ever been.
Good, great. Couldn't agree more.
But here's the other thing. And again, not to, like, we're going way out on the outer rim of thought here, at least for me. Television shows are basically determined, their length, all of it, the number of seasons it gets, all of that is basically determined by capitalism. And not to get all socialist about it, but it's true. Yes. Television, the form of storytelling of television exists because of capitalism. The length of a movie, more or less, with some exceptions, and obviously there are some very big exceptions, is based around the human ability to sit still and watch a movie for a certain amount of time.
Agreed.
And that's kind of, you know, people lose that now. But it's like Alfred Hitchcock said, the length of a movie is determined by the size of the human bladder. And
he's not fucking wrong, actually. He's not wrong.
And if I were to ever start someday I hope to start a film company, and I really want to call it Tight 90. Because I'm a big believer in the Tight 90.
I'm fucking in, man. I'm in. Like, right? And this movie as an epic. Like, let's talk the runtime. I actually said to my friend Maria, I said, have you seen Last of the Mohicans? And she said, no, it's probably some Michael Mann bullshit that's like 5 hours long. Was exactly
her
point.
Who called you out on Twitter that one time?
Yes, she was.
Yeah, okay. Cool.
I love that that's her reputation now again in this podcast. But I said, no, it's actually less than 2 hours. I said, it's an hour 40-ish.
Yeah.
And when have you ever heard of an epic that has got this level of production? That is this strong and this focus that is just like, I'm going to do this and then it's done. And I think it's so rare. Again, like in a movie that we're talking about, the finale, which is 12 minutes, seemingly long, like if you think about a finale and the conclusion of the movie, but it's like, it's so tight, like a tight 90. Man, a really tight, punchy 90-minute movie.
Yeah.
They can't be beaten. I love the name too. And copyright you.
I need to copyright it. No, and this is where, and I get to sit out this giant chunk of film Twitter by just not going to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Because I don't really go see 3-hour movies, and not his anymore. And so I get to be the guy who doesn't have an opinion about it, which really is a great place to be right
now. Sometimes it can be really nice. It's really nice to not have an opinion about a 3-hour movie.
But sorry, I could go off forever. I mean, I think when you, to jump around, because we don't need to break it down because you have so many people talking about it, there's so many good things. It's such a tragedy. You know, you lose the second to last of the Mohicans. Falls under Magua's knife, right? Madeline Stowe's sister jumps off the cliff.
Alice is gone. Uncas is gone.
And then, there's so many moving parts. It's all so beautiful. The shot, my favorite shot, and it's not a moving shot. When Last of the Mohicans, I know you have all these names. I just got. I'm looking at it on Twitter now.
Chingachgook.
Chingachgook. Last of the Mohicans.
Russell Maines. There we go.
Yeah, this guy, Magua has just killed his son. He's not fucking around anymore. Magua sees him coming, and does this move where he. I'm going to do it for you, the audience can't see me because they're not on Skype.
I'm going to describe.
He kind of like, it's like
a presentation of weapons. It's
presentation
it's,
of weapons.
You know what it is? I just fucking realized it when we were both doing it to each other on Skype right now. It's the Henry Cavill arm cocking from Mission Impossible Fallout. Well before that, but it's actually weapons. It's like, here we go. Yeah. Like he's got
a knife and an axe, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's exactly that. It's the equivalent of like, okay. And he does. It's a totally. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't put him in motion. It's just like, oh, another motherfucker. All right. And then Last of the Mohicans absolutely suns him. I mean, like, just fucks him up. And that's what's. It's so fast. It's not a vicious. I mean, it's a vicious fight, but it's like, oh no, he toyed with the son, and then the dad just toys with him.
Yeah.
And puts that massive battle club straight fucking through him.
Yes.
Gives him a compound fracture on the arm. I mean, it is violent.
Yes. And there is what I love, and it's so funny, and you get this in your writing too, and I know that you're an Elroy fan, of course, with you and I both have, I think, an affinity for really fucking direct dialogue, like straight to the point, and also straight to the point violence, because violence in a lot of films is often glamorized, but one of the things that I think you and I appreciate and the things that we like is that when something is really violent, it's not very flashy, it's direct. And what I love about this Magua sequence with Chingachgook is he goes up, he baits him into a shot. Magua swings this tomahawk around, Chingachgook ducks it, rolls under, and just goes belt. And just it completely eliminates an arm. His arm that's holding an axe now has a compound fracture of the elbow. He can't move his arm anymore. And then when he gets up, he just starts battering him on the side, on the opposite side. So then he's on both sides. And then completely just trashes his shoulder, just in case your arm might be able to get through this with the adrenaline surge you're about to feel. Like every shot is, it's like 4 or 5 debilitating injuries on top of one another before he eventually does that killing blow, which he takes no satisfaction, and both of those kills, Margo's kill of Uncas and also Chingachgook too, taking him out, he's not satisfied at all with having to kill him in that moment.
No, it's not a cackling like haha.
No.
It's not even really a mocking like that's right. It's just like, oh, you killed my son, I now have to kill you. But it's so direct. It's literally his son has been dead. Like his son is probably still body temperature, right?
Yes, yes.
He has not yet begun to cool. And just to go back for a second and talk about trademark phrases and a new script I have hoping to sell a TV show very soon. I have a line of like a statement of intent in it, which is we don't do action. We do violence.
Yes.
Which is exactly what you're talking about. It's not flashy kung fu moves. It's not a million machine guns going off and nobody getting hit. It is violence that has a plot purpose and a character purpose united. Nobody does it better than man. I'm thinking about, you want to do a podcast about the Miami Vice movie.
Don't start. There's already, you know what happened? You saw what happened on Twitter. As soon as I announced this, the thread underneath it became every man fan and their dog pitching me what the next show was. And I did actually say I was never going back. And I'm back.
And you're back just when you thought you were out. They pull you back in. Do you remember, like, very early in that film, there's a drug deal between some Russians and some Aryan Brotherhood guys.
Yes.
And I believe it's the Aryan Brotherhood who has basically like a 50 cal machine gun that on they open up on a car full of people. Uh-huh. And man just obviously like wired some dummies with explosives. And you literally see an arm come off at the shoulder.
Yes.
But it's not in slow. I mean, maybe it is in slight slow-mo, but it is, it's just like very like, oh no, this is what happens when somebody gets shot with a big gun.
With a 50 cal, and it just eats the car and eats that person. Like, it's like, oh shit. Like, it's like, this is not made, you know, that whole thing of like, this is not made for humans. You know, that 50 cal gun is like, we're just going to chop you into mincemeat. Like, we don't care. There's not like, you're not going to get winged and walk away. Your arm's going to fly off.
So when this happens and Magua is so thoroughly defeated, you're correct in that there's no pleasure on the father's face. There's no really emotion at all. And what's also interesting, to go back to Magua, is there's not really – Magua's facial expression isn't agony, and it's not – there's no kind of fear, and there's no kind of like begging or anything. But he's also not like falsely bravado. It's just kind of like, what the fuck just happened? Mm. Like, he just – oh. This week he did not think he was going to lose this fight. He just got his ass handed, and now he's just standing there waiting to die because he lost the fight, so he's going to die now.
I love that what you said there is like there is like this minor wince, and it's like, how the fuck did this happen? That's literally the translation that I've had in my head forever. It's like he's got this wince of like, how the fuck did this happen? And then there's a realization. And it dawns, and it's done in two cuts because it cuts back to Russell Means as Chingachgook, and then it cuts back to Magua. And so the first one, Magua's wincing, and then it cuts to Chingachgook, and he's kind of got blood on his head, and he's sort of shaking his head like, you made me do this. Like, this is the last thing that I want to be doing. I don't want to be fighting other Huron. I don't want to fight other Indian tribes, Native American tribes. I don't want to fight any of this shit. I was taking my sons. We're going to Kentucky. We're getting out of here. Yeah. And the freaking French Indian War just stopped by, and you fucked with my son, and now I'm here. And he says that all in no seconds, all words.
Right.
It just is all passed in, this is not where I wanted to be today, and especially with you. And Margo is kind of like, by the time he cuts back to him, and it happens in such fleeting amount of seconds, he's just like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'm ready to die.
And it's all timed perfectly. And again, the score, it's not in a large crescendo. It's actually kind of in a slow refrain. And the music comes down for this moment, and you just get to live in that moment between these two guys. And again, you're right. It's like he doesn't want – this is not good. It's a tragedy for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody – if your sister isn't dead, then your son is dead and your tribe's extinct. Or, you know, I guess Natty Bumppo comes out the best because he only kind of lost sort of a stepbrother. And his girlfriend's sister is. I mean, nobody. You're like, where do you go?
And
like,
he did. And he did have to kill the guy who essentially gave him his partner, right? Like, he saved his girl's life, and he had to shoot him in the head. So they're all kind of
As a bud, he does it as a bro. You know, that's what bros do for bros.
Hey, bros do for bros. You shoot me in the head if I'm on fire, bro. Okay.
Yeah.
You shoot
me. That's right.
In the fucking head.
If I'm on fire, you can't get to me, because that's important. First, try and get to me.
Try and get to
me. If you can't get to me,
shoot.
Fair enough.
You shoot me in the head quickly. Because let's not forget, talking about violence and not action, that scene of him burning has been burning in the back of my retinas since the minute I saw it. It is one of the most disturbing cinematic deaths ever. Like, you are so grateful for his death. Like, you love him in that moment. He's in total redemption mode, and then he's murdered in the most savage way possible.
Yeah, because, you know, they could have gone badly if like, obviously Natty Bumppo doesn't miss, but were Natty Bumppo to miss and just kind of wound him?
Like, it's the worst punishment of all time.
just like shoot him in the knee or something like real painful, just to kind of like
fucking stick the knife in, bro. That's
yeah, that, icing in the cake.
Not cool, bro.
That's not what bros do for bros. Bros don't miss.
Oh, bros don't miss.
Just now that we're on the lighter end, when you say Kentucky, have you watched, and just when we were talking about all the different things to explore in this film, the Ben Stiller show, which was a sketch show he did in the 90s.
You know what? So I'm so glad you brought this up, because I'd never heard of it. And in the last, and three people who I've talked to for this show have like, Blake, stop what you're doing right now. You need to watch this. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to pause for everyone. If you don't know what we're talking about, the Ben Stiller show does an amazing sketch about The Last of the Mohicans at peak funny Ben Stiller. I'm going to cut it into this episode right now.
Hi, I'm Daniel Day-Lewis. And those of you who've seen Last of the Mohicans know that much of the plot consists of my character Hawkeye running from one place to another. Running up hills. Running across fields. Through rivers. Running. Running and more running. How did I get into shape for all this running, you ask? The answer is this. The Mohican Master 2000. When I want a light warm-up, I set the master to chased by bears. For more of a challenging workout, I move on to pursued by flesh-eating Huron tribesmen. And for full-on aerobic training, I press surrounded by drunken Yankee trainers with muskets. Ah! Wow. Workout like that'll sweat off your tribal tattoos. You know, the Mohicans may have been last in the race to survive, but they were number one when it came to cross-training. So come on, what are you waiting for? Get yourself a master. It helped put the I can back into this Mohican.
The Mohican Master 2000. Get yours today.
Warning! If something goes wrong on the treadmill, stay on! Do not get off! I will come! No matter what occurs, I will fix it! That's my personal...
Ahoo! And for a limited time, get a rebate on Jazzercise with Wolves, the step aerobic system by Kevin Costner.
Okay, feel yourself scalping that weight away. Scalp it off! Scalp it off! This offer not available in Kentucky.
But yes, Jordan, please talk about what people have just listened to.
Well, it's just, it really kind of gets to the fact that, like, Daniel Day-Lewis is obviously a great actor, but, like, sometimes great actor choices are bad choices. And one of those bad choices is, and you know it was him. It wasn't anybody else. It was him who said, no, they wouldn't say Kentucky. They'd say Kentucky. Yeah. And so what we have just seen is obviously Ben Stiller really kind of roasting Daniel Day-Lewis, which you go like, who are you to roast Daniel Day-Lewis? I will say this, find a Philip Seymour Hoffman performance that you could make fun of the way you can make fun of Daniel Day-Lewis's performance in this movie. You can't do it. No. There's something, look, is Daniel Day-Lewis a fantastic actor? Yes, he is. But like this kind of level of authenticity, they would say, oh, he stayed in character when he played Abraham Lincoln. And whenever I hear something like that, I go, no, he didn't. Because if he was in character as Abraham Lincoln, he would be saying, where am I? What's going on? Where did you get all these candles? Why are there candles everywhere floating now, in the air?
No, I dare not do the impression. But I'm going to beg of you, Jordan, and anyone who hasn't had a chance, if you're listening to this as your first episode of The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, thank you and welcome. An overdue thank you and welcome. Sean Burns, a hilarious and sardonic and also insanely talented film critic, tells me a story that I am dying for you to hear, Jordan, about when for, I think it was The Crucible, which was shot in Boston, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. His character's name was John. There was a bunch of Boston people and people that Sean knows, like builders and just tradesmen who were building the sets for that movie. And at the time, Daniel Day-Lewis basically had a demand with the filmmakers that he would go down to where they were constructing the set because he, John, wanted to build John's house by hand.
Uh-huh.
And Sean's story about the construction workers... is one of my favorite stories I've ever heard on this show. So I just want you to have a listen to that. I'm just going to give that a little tease. But yeah, it's really interesting. Like there is this weird layer of like, please call me that name. I've always wondered that, like, please call me that name, but also like, do I, you know, I think Daniel Day-Lewis in some of these older movies does take it to the limit. Like, he's like, call me Nathaniel, call me Hawkeye. I'm going to run around the set. I'm going to carry the guns. I'm going to sleep outside. I'm going to be an outdoorsman. But also now, like, you know, a little bit easier when you're Reynolds Woodcock, but like, really, is he sleeping outside the whole time that he's Daniel Plainview? Like, is he doing that? I don't know. It's really funny. But like, yeah, that's a, you know, talk about tragedy. That's the tragedy of losing someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman, because that guy is effortlessly brilliant in every film he's ever been in, without question. There's not an exception. He's a brilliant.
No, there really isn't. And you know, the one, now that we've taken old Daniel Day-Lewis down a peg, about time. You know, you want to know how great an actor Philip Seymour Hoffman was? Watch the first 5 minutes of the Mission Impossible that he's in. Mm-hmm. Because it's a performance in a Mission Impossible movie, which are good movies. I don't want to say they're bad movies, but they're Mission Impossible movies. And he's fucking terrifying it.
Yeah. And he makes Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt, like, shaking his boots in such a really authentic way. And I think Cruise compliments his performance so well there. He surrenders to, like, here's the big dog on set right now, you know, like, yep. Having those two and that point counterpoint, so effective, so effective. It's my almost favorite face off with Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's that, and it's Adam Sandler and he facing off in Punch Drunk Love. They are my two favorite face offs when he's just that fucking angry furniture salesman / extortionist. It is just dynamite. Two of my favorite face-offs with that legend. Well, look. Oh, my goodness.
Sorry. Speaking of Adam Sandler, did you see that he's in the new Safdie Brothers film?
I know. Uncut Gems. Hearing lots of amazing stuff.
I can't wait.
I love the Safdie Brothers. So wonderful. Saw Good Time. I was so glad. I missed Good Time when it was at the theater and I watched it. I watched it on Netflix. This is the one time that you love streaming television so much. It's like, I watched it on Netflix and I just went, send a play again. And just watched it back to back. I was like, that movie was brilliant. I'm going to go again. Thank you.
An amazing movie.
Really good. Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, there was like three or four moves there to get from Last of the Mohicans to Uncut Gems.
To Adam Sandler right now.
Yeah.
Look, and if that's my talent, and from anyone who's listened to One Heat Minute, the digressions got really strong. They were really strong digressions. Jordan.
But, yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, man. Really, Blake, just, you don't have to do Michael Mann movies, but just, you know, keep doing these and I'll keep showing up. It's so much fun.
Thank you. Thank you. Look, and there will be more movies that this happens to. Inclement Vice is on the way. Jordan is already a guest, which I can reveal right now as an exclusive with our wonderful host, Travis Woods. You guys can hear that episode when that comes out. That's a 45-episode series, which you'll be able to hear soon. And if you're listening to this, it might already be out, so go check it out. There'll be links in the description if that's the case. But man, thank you so much for being a part of this. Huge admirer of your work, as you know, and I'm really looking forward to seeing Dune come out, the Danny Villeneuve film, number one, and then The Sisterhood. Doing what the Dark Tower never did. Fingers crossed. I'm hoping for that. Jordan, thank you so much.
Man.
At Jordan Harper.
Thanks for having me.
You can find him on Twitter and you can find his books everywhere. She Rides Shotgun. Incredible. Highly recommend it. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Talk to you later.
Talk soon.
Well, it just wouldn't be me doing another podcast that takes up a significant slice of my life about Michael Mann without my next guest. He helped me kick it off and he helped me bring it home. A dear, dear friend, the third leg and girthiest leg of the tripod of the Cinephiles podcast. He's one of the sharpest film minds and forever will be in my crew. He's my ride or die. And in fact, he's growing his hair so beautifully and magnificently right now that he could almost be my Val Kilmer to my Neil McCauley. Here's Mr. Stu Coote. Stu, welcome to the last 12 minutes of the Mohicans.
I'm inspired by Daniel Day-Lewis's glorious long locks. So I'm very privileged to be back. Thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure to talk incremental portions of films with you, no matter what they are.
So first things first, when I first told you I was doing this, what was your immediate thought?
I was like, how many episodes, how long is the movie? And you went, no, it's only the final 12 minutes. I'm like, oh, so that's a Tuesday for you. Shouldn't take you any time at all.
Oh, that's and it was funny that you say that because it was actually a Tuesday, was the day that the idea occurred to me and I started throwing it out there. And so here we are, you and I were bookended and obviously you're on the journey for many of it, for every episode as a listener. Thank you for that. And as a feedback giver, but you're on the entire journey of Heat, which is, I think, is an unbridled masterpiece, almost unparalleled, I think, in anything that man or most filmmakers have done, especially in crime cinema. And when I came to The Last of the Mohicans, I thought, it is absolutely a movie that is worth scrutiny and absolutely a movie that is worth the scrutiny and the discussion. But much like I did said in the final episodes, I don't think it was me that was going to be going through every painstaking detail, but I just don't think my, what do you call it? I don't think the method that I have of talking about films is as good when I'm only talking about it for an hour. I think where some people can articulate things in a tweet, yourself very much included in that, and some people can write things in a really florid, piece of writing, like some of the magnificent guests that are going to be on this show. I think maybe my best thing that I do is when I can continue to find passion in unpacking and scrutinizing the living daylights out of a movie a minute at a time.
Well, I think that's half the joy, though, isn't it? Of like going around and looking around every nook and cranny to see how it holds up or doesn't hold up. But I think, putting any bit of art to that scrutiny is always fun because some will very quickly collapse.
Yes.
And others will stand the test of time and will be handed down from, Heat will be handed down from generation to generation as it has already. It is. One of the best heist films, one of the best crime films, one of the best cops and robbers films. In a similar way, this, I don't know if how Mohicans is aging. I think it's beloved. I don't know if it'll stand the test of time, but it's.
I think much like the 90s as a decade feels like it's aging well for movies because people sort of go, oh, it was this garbage decade. It wasn't the 70s, nor was it the 80s. But as we move away from it, it's like, no, what was great about it was that what it shared with sort of late 60s, early 70s was there was a tendency of a bit of a collapse. So you had these big studios financing like things like Miramax, and you had all the emergences of who are now the dominant filmmakers, the Quentin Tarantinos, the Paul Thomas Andersons, the Coen brothers. You had them all sort of emerging late 80s, early 90s out of independent cinema before they sort of hit the mainstream and the critical acclaim. And I think Mohicans is kind of like, oh, look at this big popcorn epic blockbuster. But in the grand scheme of things, like no one ever really thought it would outlive something like Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, but it kind of is because
who the hell's talking? Who the hell wants to go back? No offense, but who the hell wants to go back and watch 4 hours? Because I don't even know if there's a theatrical cut on DVD or Blu-ray. Who wants to watch the 4 hour Kevin Costner cut of Dances with Wolves as a first helping? Like, surely you just want to have a crack at it. 2 hours 50.
Yeah, it feels like, that's his pure ego sort of driven thing, but it feels like this period of the 90s, so like the early 90s, was maybe the last of the time these big epics could be done before CG came in, but they were sort of they were the last of the throwback to sort of older Hollywood, like yes. That last of the let's do it big, let's do it on location. like lots of extras, lots of moving parts. And you kind of think in a way, like you wish George Lucas, something like if he had made the prequels in the early 90s with the confines of the 90s, just before that technology kicked off in a really big way, mostly by him.
That's true. Would we ever have gotten behind the scenes footage of George Lucas using a laser pointer going, I want more droids here, I want more droids there? We would never have had that. So that's a gift. That's a gift that keeps on giving on the Phantom Menace behind the scenes.
It's that last of the throw of the dice, I think, before, you know, we're still getting things around this period like, you know, Braveheart and whatnot, yeah, where it's still people on location, lots of extras, lots of moving parts, which is beautiful to watch. Like I've been meaning to rewatch this forever, and I loved Last of the Mohicans. I still do. I'm very fond of it. It's really interesting going on the journey through Heat and One Heat Minute. I went back and finally caught up with a lot of the man stuff that I hadn't seen before.
Yes.
And then rewatched things like Miami Vice, which, you know, that's a thing that is like a fine wine. That's almost ready to crack.
Stop it. If I don't know exactly what order people are going to be hearing the guests on this show talk to me, but the few people are like, come on, Blake, give Miami Vice a crack. Give it a crack. Yeah, I'm saying... The people on Twitter, and this is actually from guests of the show, were like harassing me to do Vice next. One Michael Mann masterpiece at a time, people. Thank you very much.
I don't know if you'd want to, I'm not sure Miami Vice is something you'd want to revisit on an almost weekly basis like you need to with these shows. It's good, but it's not, I've got yearly films. And I've got sort of 18 months, 2 years films. That'd be closer into the sort of the 2 year category where how often you need to sort of dust them off. But things like I hadn't seen The Insider, I hadn't seen Ali, and hadn't seen Thief as well. So I was lucky enough to catch that in the cinema. But I was then starting to pick up, I guess, what over that 2 year period of One Heat Minute, I would have watched Heat maybe 20 times in preparation for various shows or cinematic releases that we caught it on, like, you know, the 2 times it was in cinema in that time.
Yes.
And so it was interesting then to come back to now with all that sort of man filmography floating around in my head and all these little flourishes to then reapply it back to Last of the Mohicans, because, you know, I knew Last of the Mohicans before I knew names of directors. Like you didn't, yeah, like, you know, I would have been probably 11 or 12 when I first saw this,
yeah,
which is probably the perfect age, you know, because it's not quite a swashbuckling adventure, because it's more serious than that.
Yes.
But it does have that kind of, like, you know, not something as campy as, say, Pirates of the Caribbean, but it feels of an age where we're looking at a historical period, which is sort of akin to that. Maybe this is more like his version of Zulu in a way.
Yeah.
Like in terms of like seeing the actual, like, you know, the white man on display, as it were, and being quite critical of sort of things against the indigenous peoples and the, like, you know, the everyone's motivations. It maybe has that. It sort of lives in that world of epics more than anything else.
Yeah, it's absolutely got swashbuckle. I think it's got some of those, all those ingredients you just talked about. It's got swashbuckling. It's got political commentary. But I think Michael Mann's version of political commentary is just detail. Like his aesthetic, his preparation, the tapestry of what he's trying to weave is the political commentary. You know, when you've got huge colonial superpowers that are butting up against an emerging democratic, you know, of the eventual superpower of the world, butting against multi indigenous national societies, and them all playing espionage on one another just to pillage this entire continent and divvy it up the way that they want. And that's not so much for the indigenous peoples because they've got their own zones, but sort of like them sort of clutching for survival. That's Michael Mann's way of, like, having this big sort of, you'd call it like second layer or you know second plot of the entire movie as they're sort of navigating through it. But then the A plot, that's the B plot. The A plot is a really small co-op of characters bashing against it. And so yeah. I think that's what really clever directors do. They can use these and in very, very recently, I think it's very Tarantino as well in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is to use like 2 to 3 characters to tell an epic story of the United States at a sort of turning point in sort of socio-political culture, and sort of revisiting it and revising it. And this is man going back to James Fenimore Cooper's, in a way, to his sort of foundational, if kind of dunderheaded, text of American literature and a stereotype creator, and going, no, we're going to apply a more intellectual lens to the makeup of the society. And then we're going to tell a big swashbuckling, romantic, beautiful story on top of it that actually makes sense and doesn't just treat everyone like a stereotype, basically.
Exactly. Maybe it is a bit of a white savior film. That was one thing I sort of wrestled with on this viewing. It's sort of trying to, like, more and more, just because, you know, we've had so many issues. Like, and I'm still learning very much in terms of representation issues. And sort of thinking, like, I love this film for all the reasons I hate The Revenant.
Yes.
Like, The Revenant doesn't feel earnest to me.
But
this feels...
Inaritu loves Last of the Mohicans. And sure. And you can tell.
Oh, yeah, 100% you can tell. And it doesn't work. But then I was thinking of this, like, I know the story's the story. You have to analyze the art you get, not the art you want. But I thought on this watch, what would have been interesting is if you swapped, like, I know this might be heresy to say, if you swapped Daniel Day-Lewis out and just had Eric Schwaig or whoever it is playing Uncut.
Yeah.
As the lead, it would have been very interesting not to have this, like, you know, the quote-unquote white guy in there who's been raised by the natives and therefore is sort of got a foot in each camp. Because, I mean, basically, I guess the story is he's always trying to do the right thing by both sides and trying to be this mediator. But he's almost too saint-like in this. It's almost a bit on the nose with how proficient he is as a sort of a warrior, but then how sort of
He's Michael Mann's great American hero. This is Michael. This is him at his most sincere, I guess, like being the great American hero. And from what I understand from the original novel, which I haven't read, but from what I understand from the original novel, is Nathaniel Poe, aka Hawkeye. His name was Natty Bumpo. A good name change from the original novel. And he was just like a trapper. Like, he was a trapper, much in the ilk of Leo DiCaprio in The Revenant sort of guy. Like, just a trapper. He was a white trapper. His family had lived there. He comes in. He has this relationship with this, you know, the daughter of a white colonel, etc. Cora's fate is different in the book. I particularly like Hawkeye, and I still like him because I think it's an interesting revision on, like, the Magua thing. I think in when you go back to this now, especially after you watch Heat, like, the Magua Hawkeye similarity is so much more pronounced for me when I watch this again, because of the way that, you know, Magua is a guy who's orphaned from his tribe in a raid on a war party, gets readopted by another tribe, and then adopts himself into the French tribe before sort of coming back to his Huron people and trying to return as this savior, adopting all these ways of the French. And then you've got Hawkeye, Nathaniel Poe, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, who's a white guy, who's a trapper, who's in the States, who really is there, like, meant to be aligning with these colonial militias, meant to be aligning with these guys, and he just doesn't give a rat's. Like, he cares about them, but he cares about his intimacy of his family group first and foremost, and that's who he cares about. So I kind of like how it's like these weird things of like family and scale and doing what you think is right or doing what you believe is right based on the people that you've been raised by. But it's never really on the nose with him. I think it's like, it's a great American hero. For me, I don't know. Like, I totally get that some people might feel it's on the nose. Hell, he's running around with his damn shirt open, his chest glistening, his hair being gorgeous, him taking every shot.
There's no real gray to the character. Like, man, like after watching most of his filmography, rewatching most of his filmography, you are getting that analysis of what a man is or what a man does or the inner conflict. There didn't seem to be a great inner conflict, in terms of like a breakdown, because it's all like,
no, he's the peak. I think he's the peak. You know, even Mann himself calls him in the documentaries and in the sort of verbiage about the film and any interviews that I've researched so far. You know, he says this is his great American hero. This is his captain. This is his Captain America. instead of wielding a shield, it's a tomahawk
and a shotgun. But it feels like that. It just feels, you know, and maybe, you know, it's still maybe that sort of old storytelling of, you know, good versus evil. Like, whereas Poe is sort of, oh, I'm not here to do the right thing. I'm just looking out for me. Wink, wink. I'm actually here because I'm fighting with love in my heart. Whereas Mogwai is sort of very much hate in his, and it's sort of, well, that's not going to win. But yeah, I also would have liked to see, instead of Nathan Poe, I would have liked to see Cameron Poe from Con Air. I think that, because they would have equally nice hair to be running around in the wilderness.
What do you call it? Is it like deep fakes? There's someone who can. There's someone
he's
who can.
They know the way and they show the way. He's an army ranger. Like,
there's someone in the deep fakes of the internet that can put Cameron Poe's face on Nathaniel Poe's face in this movie and just get a clip up. Please tag us at Blake is Batman at Stu_Watchers.
Well, look,
we've digressed enough. Let's talk about the ending. Let's talk. So, you know, obviously you said you watched this film a long time ago. So did I. I watched it when I was a kid, probably inappropriately aged to watch men have their hearts cut out in front of us, etc. It was at a very, you know, at a formidable age, this movie, you know, left a mark. But, you know, as someone who has watched me go through the Heat epic, you know, this final 12 minutes, can you just, you know, when we talk about cinematic flourishes, when we talk about the use of music, when we talk about performance, when we talk about editing, is there really, you know, and I think I know the answer to this, but is there really many films that have ever done it better than the final 12 minutes of this movie?
No, it wraps it up again, because it's the storytelling throughout is so efficient, and there is not a single frame wasted in this final 12 minutes. You got that pounding score, and you've got, because I on this watch, I think that the two winners are obviously that score is number one.
Yes.
And then number two is the camera of Dante Spinotti. Like that, it is just beautiful to look at, which is, you know, probably a movie of where they are is half the reason. Like, you've got a master cinematographer there, but then also a beautiful area to shoot. But the way Mann knows when to hit the emotion well, like when Mogwa kills Untas, and his father then like comes running through. I love that it stays on the score, and yes, you can't see him, you can't hear him screaming.
Yeah,
good. You see the anguish on his face as he comes round, and some of those imageries are just burned. Like, I forgot how cruel Mogwa was. Like, how he toys with him, and he's torturing him all the way to the end. I mean, really, there's no nobility with the way that he's dispatching someone. And then I love how then when his father comes through, how it's the wily old warrior who's been doing it the whole time, and how quickly he dispatches. Like, when you see an actual true warrior in his peak, dispatching Mogwai the way we just. Zero patience for him, and just sort of, it's again, it was so visceral though. It's and again, it even gets in, like, I'm still wrestling with the sort of Alice committing suicide, which is, you know, one of the more beautiful love stories that's weaved throughout this. That, you know, a lot of the focus goes on Madeline Stowe, and rightly so. I think she's phenomenal, and I don't think it's a name that crops up enough when people are talking about, like, strong female performances and strong, like, actresses in general. I think she has, like, her chemistry with Daniel Day-Lewis is palpable throughout. Like, not even just the awkward Roadhouse-style Patrick Swayze standing sex scene. But,
hey. In all movies, there needs to be title holders for different things.
Yeah.
And if a standing shag is on your list, is on your trophy cabinet, I don't think there's anything to sneeze at. You know, MTV's got this stupid best movie kiss of the year. I mean, the best standing shag, that's a 10-year award, and they've got it. I don't think I've seen anything remotely close. That's, you know, a lot of classless things, but this one's like it's chaste love, it's direct, it's sexy as, you don't know whose hair's whose. Both have got beautiful hair.
But yeah, it's so moving and it's so poetic, this ending. It's, you know, as kids growing up, I love when Nathaniel comes through and, like, grabs the guy's gun that he's just shot, like little touches like that. And it's like, of course he did, because it was already loaded, and it's all about efficiency and about moving and doing stuff on the run. It'd be like, you know, the old Robin Hood thing of, like, pulling the arrow out of the person you've just shot and using it again, because that's the world that they've created, and that's the tension.
Yes.
And also doing the two rifle shot is very cool as well. It reminds you when they're doing the sniper stuff, when the people are running out of the fort. I think it's a nice sort of callback to his sort of his gunplay. They're so good.
They are very, very extremely cinematic, and God, Dante and Mr. Man love beautiful slow-mo close-ups with those muskets. They're just delightful.
They do. You know, that is sort of, you know, like you say, those little man touches, because I don't know, you know, for the most part, man is pretty much a workman in terms of, like, the camera movement. Everything feels sort of more classic.
Yeah, classic and classic and... He's a weird one, right? Because I feel like you're going to say that, like, he's a functional director. Like, he works on function and detail, and he's very good at both those things. And he never would like to be referred to, he'd never like to be referred to as a pure stylist. Like, he doesn't like that word, because he feels like
he's not
too
showy.
Yeah, I think that's what he thinks of when you think of a stylist, as opposed to style. Like, what is his style? What is the immediacy of what he's trying to create? What is the distance that he likes to keep you with his characters? But yeah, he's definitely got, there's a great aesthetic in this. You just reminded me, though, it's funny about details with man, like foreshadowing. And one of the things that I don't think I've mentioned yet when talking about this in this series is, it's one of my favorite things is when Uncas, Hawkeye, and Chingachgook first come upon Cora, Duncan, and Alice as part of the British, group that is sort of escorting them to Fort William Henry before they're accosted by Magua's small war party. So he's got like a smallish war party. And I just love, there's a moment where Duncan picks up a musket and Hawkeye walks over to him and, like, pushes the musket muzzle away. And he's like, in case your aim's any better in your judgment, because he's about to shoot Chingachgook. But I just love in that moment, like you said before about him just sort of doing his thing that he's been doing the whole movie. And you forget that, like, he just mops up like 20 guys in the bush by himself. And like, Hawkeye and Uncas are out in the fray, but Chingachgook's just like in the woods, like a wolf, just sort of, you know, sort of navigating his way through each brush branch, and as someone streams away or someone goes to attack the guys from in there, he's just like mopping them up one after the other. And so you only get to see that sort of single beautiful, like, where he throws that whatever the hell that gorgeous thing is that weapon he's got.
It's not quite an axe, it's not quite like a machete, it's like a curved machete almost. Like, it's a brutal weapon.
Yeah, it's brutal.
But the ending,
he's Wonder Boy.
I did enjoy, like, it's an odd film. It's like, how much time we spent in that fort for what we were there, what, maybe 20 minutes at most, maybe not even, maybe 20. And it's the same with that village at the end that they put together for like where they're doing where Duncan meets his demise. But you're like, look what you've built and put together just for one small little portion. It's just, again, the attention, the scale of this film is huge. Like,
I'm gonna go behind the curtain. I was talking to Stu about coming onto the show because it felt wrong to not have him on the show so far. And he goes, I watched it last night. And I said, oh, yeah, what'd you think? And he goes, it wasn't long enough.
Yeah.
I wanted more. How rare is that for a movie? Like how, and this is why I really wanted to focus on the ending of this movie, is how rare is that to get to the end of a movie and go, I could have done a couple more hours in that world without breaking a sweat.
There's probably an extra 40 minutes there where they could have just let some scenes breathe a little bit more and stretch the legs out a bit. What's the saying? No bad film is short enough and no good movie is too long.
Yes, like, yes.
It really is though. Like there were times where I'm like, just, you know, it's like when you're playing a video game, you just want to like get off your horse and go walk around the town. Like even when we sort of got to that fort, I know we saw a lot of it from the cannon fire, et cetera. But like I wanted to, like, this is like a full set they built.
They built three sides of a fort in North Carolina from the wood that they cleared. They built it from the wood there.
It feels like we didn't even get to see enough of the inner work. Like we only got sort of the meetings with the guys, but there were, you know, functioning stables and there were stores and there was everything. And you're going, my goodness, this is grand. In that, like nowadays, that would be, that's a CG. The whole thing is CG.
Yeah.
Like, the village at the end would be like, you know, the rock, like that rock fight would be on a soundstage somewhere, just built and help. Maybe we wouldn't be able to tell the difference. That's fine. But these people were out there.
Do you really think that? Do you really think that? We sat in a one movie together this year. We sat in one movie together this year. We've seen a stack of movies together, but one particular, an absolutely stunning film called Monos, shot on actual locations in South America, in locales that had never been filmed before. And when we were watching it, I know we sort of finished the film, came out at the end of it, and we were like that felt as close to being on an alien landscape like Star Wars as anything else. And so if you haven't seen Monos, I can't recommend it higher. Probably my favorite movie of the whole year.
Hard to find, but if you get it at like a festival or something, it's definitely,
I believe, it's getting a theatrical run in the States, small. As we're talking now, we're in early September. I believe it's mid-September, end of September, that it's sort of getting a little bit of a wider release around the States.
Did you catch Embrace of the Serpent a couple of years ago?
Yeah, that was then went to Netflix. Yeah, I did. Again.
That's the same thing. It's in that sort of, not that they're just South American, but it's like that feeling of, yeah, the alien, like finding locations. And there is there's something visceral and real. But then you see other things where, you know, they go, oh, that whole set piece was CG. And you're like, oh, I didn't know. It looked like when it's not a flying alien or it's not a big blue light in the sky. But I think that there's just
something about, there's something that this film, there's something that films like Monos, there's something like films like Apocalypse Now, when something is happening in the frame, there's something that your mind does that says that's real.
It's like a Duncan execution was like that. Like yes. That's a horrific imagery.
Yes, horrific.
That's horrific. Yeah, and I don't know if you get that any other way than actually like,
and physically making it up and having the lighting of the fire around him or shooting through the flames to get that imagery and having the makeup graded to do that, to have that look, etc. It's visceral. It's ghastly. It's that disturbed me as a young kid and continues to disturb me every time I watch it. And I just feel like these movies, these kinds of movies, you know, and this ending particularly, and it's just to underscore the point of this ending, when you make the sacrifice, maybe financial, to cut like a little pathway in a North Carolina mountain and make sure it's got nets so that people don't fall off the fucking side of it, and choose to shoot this thing with, you know, extremely talented stuntmen and extremely talented second unit chasing Uncas up the hill, getting all the cuts, getting Hawkeye running through, shooting two guys at a time, all that sort of stuff. The payoff is, like, that's the payoff becomes timeless, because we can watch it again and again, and even on the most recent, you know, Australian releases of Ultimate Cuts with director's definitive editions and theatricals, and they're in these beautiful Blu-ray transfers, and we're watching it on ultra-high-definition televisions. It's not a lie. It just is frighteningly gorgeous every freaking time you watch it. It doesn't lose any of its luster from 92, whereas you watch, as an example, you watch, like, the first Spider-Man film, which I think is 2001, 2002. You watch the first Spider-Man film now, and that CG is like, ugh.
Yeah, it's hideous. It's like watching going back and watch Toy Story 1.
Yes.
It's just, it's not going to, it's different. Like, you look at that, like the old hand-drawn animation.
Yes.
That's going to be tight. That's
timeless.
Be tight.
Yeah. It's really, and that, it's really something.
Like, and again, this was my first exposure growing up to Wes Studi. So I always knew him from this, and because I came to Heat sort of much later. Like, I've only watched Heat, I think it was about 2007 or 8 when I first watched it. Maybe around that time, I just sort of bit the bullet one day and went, everyone's always like, I've heard so much, bang, I'm going to check this out. And obviously blown away, but to see Wes Studi, I was like, oh, I'm not really cool with Mogwa being like...
Magua's going to fucking do something here, guys. I've got a bad feeling about this guy.
It's just one of those things. Like, he just has a presence. And that look when he's got half the face, like, and his body paint, like the face paint, like his ball paint, is phenomenal. Like, it's just, he's such a powerful, like, a powerful presence on screen. Like, and there's something to his voice as well. Like, there's this timber to it and this richness that almost makes him sort of villainous at the same time in a way. Like, but then also equally, when you see him in Heat, like, he blends so well back into any other sort of...
But that's also the makeup of all those tough guys. You got Ted Levine's one of the greatest character actors working. You got Michael T. Williamson, who is obviously a giant at like 6'5 or something like that. And like... has got a big enough personality to play Don King. Like, imagine the personality that's required and the verbose nature to play Don King. You got Jane Gumm, Don King, and Magua all in the same crew with the devil and Michael Corleone. Like, this is the cops that you're dealing with. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, yeah. I think it's a perfect complementary thing. It's like, once you've got those guys together, they kind of can help measure one another out. But whereas, like, you've got Magua as this towering force, Wes Studi, and you really only get to see him go, you really only get to see him elevate to the level that you kind of have come to expect from him when he's like standing face to face with Daniel Day-Lewis as Hawkeye in front of this Sachem sort of going through this negotiation scene. And I would argue in that moment, like, although Daniel Day-Lewis is acting his pants off, he's chewing the scenery, saying all this wonderfully heroic, direct dialogue. He's like the coolest, you know, the Uber man that you could ever want. And Magua just, like, in that final scene just dwarfs him. Like, he just smashes, like, he just doesn't even feel like he's in the same league. And it's like...
Especially when you're literally seeing Magua's heart break in, like, slow motion kind of thing throughout that scene. And it's not... You wouldn't go so far as to say he throws a tantrum, but it more or less is for how reserved he has been throughout. And he can't really show the petulance before he storms off. But you just watch, there's a very subtle change in that throughout that scene, whereas Daniel Day-Lewis never, arguably doesn't ever have to do that sort of thing. His turn to be less of a prick to... Cora, maybe throughout, like, to go from sort of, but even that's not, it's not on the same level of what Magua's asked to do. And I think the physicality of that final fight suits Wes Studi very well. Like, when he sort of reels back from first time, and he's got the two little axes with him. Like, it's just, he's almost like a bird of prey kind of thing, like an evil stork up on his, or a raptor sort of thing, like about to strike.
I can't believe you're missing it. This is the guy who loves Star Wars so much. Uncas, don't try it. I've got the high ground. I was just, come on, man. Where are you? Stu's a little bit hungover. He must be, because this, I was waiting for it forever.
I do like the guy that like goes flying off the side of the rock when they, and it feels like something from like Predator or the A-Team when a grenade goes off and they go flying off. That felt like Michael Mann, the TV director.
What would have annoyed the living Daleks out of me, and what would have like John Woo'd this movie and ruined the ending, is if every second guy went flying.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
I think one guy's got to go.
Yeah, because it shows how precarious
the whole situation is.
Yeah.
Whereas...
And I do like that when sort of he does, when the dad comes through, that Day-Lewis comes home with a gun and everyone's like, no, no, they're going to have a fair fight. Yeah. I like that there's some nobility to that as well, that they go, no, no, he's got a blood right to go and challenge. He's killed his son. We're not going to interfere. No one's shooting anyone in the back. I like that. I like that aspect. Do you? And now I sort of go either way on this. Does Mugwa stab Alice there? I always got the sense when he was like lowering the knife that if she had taken the hand,
no,
he was going.
I have a slightly different opinion. Thank you for asking. That's a good question. I think that Magua in that final Uncas kill just before Alice, so I think it's important to sort of contextualize my answer. I don't think he has, I think he's his most robotic in that moment, as in he's most reflexive, he's most instinctive. He's become a killer. He's been cauterized. Like the wounds of his past have cauterized him into a killer who can reflexively and just instinctively kill and torture. And when that blood spatter hits his face from Uncas, the disgust that reads on his face is less about the disgust of Uncas or being, you know, inhuman or whatever. It's the disgust of, look what I just did. Like, I wasn't even thinking about it and I just did that. I think Alice then looks over. So what I love, there's like this profound ambiguity in Alice. Alice looks over. This is a girl who maybe 3 months ago was waving a fan in a British court on cobblestones,
yeah,
fending off suitors. Maybe was a little bit sickly. And she comes over to the Americas to go visit her dad, who's meant to be a big colonel in a fort where it's safe as houses, and wanders into the French and Indian War and has literally watched people just be butchered left and right. Like, she's just walking post-traumatic stress at this point. And in this moment of like pure kind of, it's like this, I don't know, like transcendent realization. She looks over and literally sees a guy that could have been her lover's blood dripping off of Magua's hands as he does the knife. And I genuinely think in that moment that Magua's not going to hurt her. I don't think he is. But I mean,
he's meant to be following orders to, obviously, what they were meant to go and have kids, or she was taking him up for an arranged marriage.
Yeah, he's just like, take her away to to sort of help him ease his wounds or whatever the case may be.
Him trying to be tender,
I think in that moment it's sort of tenderness as much as Magua could ever be tender. But Alice just realizes, right? She realizes it's him when he beckons tenderly, so to speak, putting the knife down. He's still holding the knife, A, and B, his hands are dripping with the blood of her lover. And so she's looking and going,
I'm good.
It's like literal rock in a hard place. It's like, well,
yeah,
if I go with him, it's not going to be great. Whatever happens, because if he gets sick of me, I'm dead. So I have to do everything he says. So I'm going into enslavement. I'm going taken off into the woods. There's no creature comforts. I'm going to be dragged along with a war party. If Michael gets sick of me, he might just toss me to his war party. And so I've got to fend for my life. You know, the real harsh, disgusting reality of what it must have been like for a woman who was passed off to a war party of any nation at that time to be taken through a war like that. And she just goes, nope, it's not going to happen. So I don't think Margaret would have killed her in that moment, but I think that Alice saw everything. She saw every single thing like a premonition in his eyes, in that gesture, in her future. I know that everything from here is not good.
And that tragedy of them only being mere seconds away for Cora to witness it as well. That never leaves me when I see her doing it, when I just see her sort of, because she's a very, not overly Jodie Mays, the actress, I'm not overly familiar with like her filmography, but
she's in a lot of things. She's absolutely magnificent in Mohicans, but I just say to everyone, keep an eye out. People may not know Jodie May at the moment off the top of their head, but she's about to be known very well. She's actually going to be one of the queens in the upcoming Witcher series for Netflix with Henry Cavill.
Oh, okay. But she's got a very, like, angelic sort of, like, ethereal sort of quality to her in this. Like, there is an innocence there that sort of Madeline Stowe brings a more of a world weariness to her and more independence.
And more shagged, more standing shagged.
So. More standing shag, whereas Jodie sort of, you only get to take her out to like a movie or something. There'll be no standing shag there. But also, how old is she meant to play? I always get the sense that
she's probably 16, 17. Cora's probably 20 at most.
Yeah, she's having to play quite young, which it still works. I mean, that was of the era that no one, yet.
Luke Perry as a teenager.
We had Emma Thompson playing 17-year-olds in, Sense and Sensibility and whatnot. So, yeah, those things happen, but there's just something to her as on that rock face that always hits me for some reason, just in that sense. But and then to finish it with just that beautiful, like looking out, like bookended by those mountain ranges, it's such a touching way to be like, you know what, we're all pretty tiny in the whole grand scheme of things. Like there's a whole lot of world out here. And we're just, a few surviving members of, our own legacy. It's an interesting thing that sort of, it's a very quiet and reflective ending to what is at times a very loud film.
And violent, extremely violent. And
and to finish it on such a, maybe a meditative sort of way, and just having that score wash over, it's an interesting choice. Whereas,
it's not as grandiose. It makes you really ruminate on it. And I think that some of the best writing, FX Feeney does some in the Michael Mann sort of coffee table book, and even the Libraries of America do a really great article, which I'll definitely link in on the Last of the Mohican webpage. The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans webpage for the podcast. But there's, these are, Cora is the end of her line. Hawkeye is the end of his. Chingachgook is the end of his line. And it's just these converging ideas, these converging ciphers in a historical context around the world's still going to keep turning. Shit's still going to go down. And these people are they're just passing through. Like the whole movie is that sense.
And I guess it could have been a variety of indigenous groups over any sort of war-torn era across history.
Yeah.
And it is a sort of a bittersweet way to go out on. But I can't really think of any other way.
No, there's no, for me, there's no happy ending.
For me, there's blood on all sides. There's grief, there's disease, there's hardship. And these are hard times in a hard place. And that realization that things are coming to an end. It's an interesting note to go out on. Whereas, a lesser storyteller would have had the girls, delivered somewhere else or, would have had, Captain like Munro would have been, or like the commander would have, General Munro would have been saved, or just, you know, there's brutality at every turn.
Even the six people, three of them die in the last 12 minutes.
Yeah.
Of the central six, right? And the villain dies too.
Yeah, and for no real gain.
No.
Like, there's really no sacrifice.
Well, Duncan goes out because of his own self-sacrifice and he gets a redemptive moment. Uncas goes out because he just can't bear to think of Alice getting passed around that war party crew. Alice makes a choice and then Chingachgook deals out. And I really love that you said there's probably another detail. And if anyone's listening to this and they kind of understand or know or particularly know what Mr. Mann researched before I get a chance to talk to him myself, but I just wonder if that, you know, that was a sort of that blood right or that gesture of, you know, standing back as something, you know, culturally significant, because I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. But
when he dispatched Mugwai, you mean?
Yeah, like as in like no one's going to take them out once that happens. I really like that touch. But I think, you know, I like endings where people have to ruminate on the weight of what they've done. Like, I don't like closure. I don't know if it's me. I don't like closure. I like when, you know, the robot that you've been talking to on your phone creates a singular consciousness with all the other robots and all the other phones and then disappears off into the universe because they're smarter than you and leaves you alone with your human connections. I like when my heroes are all killed and then the guy who dispatches them just unwittingly gets hit by a car, has a compound fracture in his arm, and then runs off into the woods, sort of thing. Like runs off into the suburbs where it's fine. I like when a ritual sacrifice from local tribespeople mirrors you murdering a kind of mad colonel up river. Like I like when movies end and there is action, but the fallout of the action and the whole like philosophical weight of the movie lands square on your shoulders. And so for me, I like this has got a nice little coda. It's a nice little eulogy, if you like, and that's where the movie ends. But when that helicopter shot goes up and just this grand world is around these three people at the end of their line, you're sitting there back ruminating on it. Like, I feel like...
It's the only time the film takes a pause.
Yeah, we haven't even had a breath.
No. Yeah, like maybe it's meant to have that driving momentum that leads you to that fateful place. Maybe that's the intention, because it does not stop. Like, even we sort of like, even when it changes days in the film, we're still hitting the ground running the next day. There is that, you know, it starts with the camera zipping by as they're chasing that buck all the way to then standing and just chilling out. Like, maybe that is the point, that they're meant to just keep going till they more or less stop there. You know, it's like paddling back in at the end of Jaws.
Yeah.
It's finally taking that moment to just stop and, you know, ponder about what's happened.
What the hell just happened? I like
that. Yeah. And it's, you know, and again, I don't think I would change anything. Like, the perfect ending doesn't need any changes, and there's not even any tinkering that I swapping out Hawkeye for Uncas in terms of the narrative.
Yes.
But anything else, like I wouldn't change a lick of the other things. So I think it's, you know, I'm so glad you launched this podcast as an exercise, as an excuse to go back and revisit it, because it's something I think I will pop this on. Now I own it as well, like fairly regularly go back and be checking it out. So one upside from your crazy ventures.
Well, I think I won't change a lick of this ending of this podcast with you. So thanks for coming back. Did you always think I was coming back to another Michael Mann film 1 minute at a time?
Of course, you can't. It's you were meant to get off the highway and get on the plane and leave, but you couldn't help yourself. You had to go... You have to go back for one more.
Oh, Jesus. Well, look, I really, really appreciate your time here, guys. Stu Coot at Stu_Watches. Cinephiles podcast, check it out, where the boys confess their cinematic sins. Josh, Liam, and of course, Stu. Mate, I wouldn't have done this process if it didn't include you in some way, shape, or form. So thanks for being a part of it, and I appreciate you coming along. To standing.
My pleasure. Thanks,
Dan. Cheers to all the standing shag talk we had off air.
The pleasure.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.